Welcome to 3GT, the podcast for three guys, a pastor, a professor, and a parishioner discuss theology from a practical standpoint, all from a Reformed perspective. Find out more at 3GT.xyz.
Welcome back to another episode of 3GT, where three guys get together and talk theology. Just a little confession here. I was told not to do this, but I find this to be the most difficult part of the show, seconded only by the conclusion of the episode. I struggle so terribly with the introductions and the conclusions, and you two don't make it any easier.
God, nobody has ever noticed your struggle.
In all seriousness, we are glad that you joined us today. We got a topic from one of our listeners, and we thought it would be a good idea to use that as kind of a springboard. A young man, Isaiah, wrote that he wanted to ask the illustrious trio. I assume that's not tongue-in-cheek. If it is Isaiah, it's well-placed. What historical theologians and thinkers should be applied more often today? I like the question, guys, but I would like to take a opportunity to maybe go a little bit deeper than that, because favorite theologians... that's about everybody could have a different favorite theologian, and I'm sure if you ask 20 pastors who their favorite theologian is, you'd get several different answers. But the reason I like the question is, I think it gives us an opportunity to share with our audience who we are. I don't know about you, but if I go to a person's house and visiting for a fellowship lunch or lunch after church. Lord's Day, one of the places I love to go is somebody's library or where they keep their books. And I just
thought you were going to say their medicine cabinet.
Yeah.
did you know I did that? Because I did have some questions about some medications that you had, but I never had the guts to ask. No. I don't think I've ever opened anybody's medicine cabinet, but I have perused their libraries on more than one occasion. And I imagine you guys have done that too. Would you say you do that? You go to somebody's house, you like looking at their bookshelves?
Certainly. Oh yeah, absolutely.
Why is that? I mean, why do you like to do that? Kyle, I'm going to ask you, why do you like to look at people's bookshelves?
Well, one, I love books.
Sure.
But two, you can tell a lot about somebody, maybe their way of thinking, some of the angles that they understand, especially if it's a theological library, who's been influential maybe in their thinking. So I enjoy doing that. And beyond just theological, I think our bookshelves do reveal where our interests lie. Mm-hmm. And so, I'm an extrovert by all those lame personality tests, but as an extrovert, I also get very nervous with awkward silences. And so I'm always, whenever I'm with people, I am writing questions in my mind. Like if there's going to be an awkward silence, what question can I ask to keep the conversation going? And actually perusing somebody's library begins to open up all kinds of conversations.
So. Sure. Well, being a passive aggressive person, I may just sit here silently.
That would
see
be
how
closest,
it affects you.
That would be the closest thing to for me.
Makes for a great podcast.
My congregation loves when I teach. They know that I get super nervous with awkward silences, and I'll ask questions, and sometimes they'll just sit there staring at me just to make me uncomfortable.
Yeah. Well, I'm putting that down in my list of things to do to make Kyle uncomfortable.
Scott, you talked about looking at people's libraries. I had a group of students over from Asia one evening, and I have my home study is in a little outbuilding that I have. And I went out there with them and their wives to see my study. And as I opened the door, all the guys ran to the bookshelves and did just what you're saying, sort of looked at the books. But I also have a gun cabinet out there. And all the ladies were fascinated by the guns. And
that was
before the night was over, that we were doing target practicing. they hadn't shot a gun before, so they were having fun with that.
And now you're living up to the stereotypical American yes. who has more guns than people in his household.
no comment on that part.
And that's what I'm getting at is, you know, people, like you said, Kyle, and I really appreciate this, you can learn a lot about people by what you see on their bookshelves, what shaped their minds, what's, you know, made them the person they are. And I would go so far as to say even a non-theological bookshelf for a library can tell you a lot about what has shaped a person's mind and, you know, tell who you are. So I just kind of wanted to take this episode and talk to you guys about different theologians that have inspired you or moved you, caused you to think the way you do. And we're not just going to leave it to, you know, any one category, but so the listeners can really, I guess, get to know us a little bit better. I mean, they've heard a lot of things like tattoos on us or lack of tattoos on us or, you know, how we feel about Valentine's Day. But I think this is another way for us to just kind of become real to people. So I wanted to ask you guys, who is your favorite theologian who is no longer living? I mean, if you were to, you know, pressed, tell me who's, or maybe your most influential, who, what theologian has influenced you the most in your walk with the Lord, who is not with us any longer?
It depends on how we would define theologian. So I'm going to throw a name out there, but I would regard him more as a preacher. Charles Spurgeon, hands down, has had more of an influence on me than probably anybody else in the history of my life. But I would regard him more as a preacher. Theologian-wise, as I sit here at my desk doing this podcast, I have two pictures on my wall right in front of me of two of my favorite theologians. One of them, obviously, because I'm Reformed, has to be John Calvin. But the other one is a Dutch theologian by the name of Herman Witsius. And Herman Witsius has had a very profound impact on shaping both my mind and my heart.
What about you, Barry?
Well, it sounds like a pat answer to say John Calvin, but he really has influenced me a great deal, just the studying the institutes and going back to them time and time again to see what he has to say about certain subjects. You know, my interest in studying the marks of the church, and I've really loved not his direct successor, but someone who was greatly influenced by Calvin and who also was a theologian in that same nation and city was Turretin. So those men have had a profound influence on my understanding, especially as I think about the gospel, but also particularly the church, which is my particular interest of study. My ecclesiology has been greatly impacted by them.
So, and I appreciate you telling us why. Kyle, why do you like Witsius so much? What is it about his works, his life that has inspired you or shaped you in the way it has?
So it all depends. Okay, so I first picked up Witsius probably now. It would have been in 2005. So 14 years ago is the first time I picked up Witsius. And the reason is because I was getting into this thing we call covenant theology, which is really the backbone of Reformed theology. And somebody was, I had asked somebody for reading recommendations and they said, well, for starters, read O. Palmer Robertson, Christ of the Covenants. And, you know, work your way up. You know, a really good guy on the covenants is this guy named Herman Witsius, who wrote this what we have is a two-volume set now, The Economy of the Covenants Between God and Man. And I was a bit of an arrogant, prideful guy, and I was like, yeah, forget O. Palmer Robertson. I'm going to go for the best guy because I kind of want this badge of honor that, I've read Herman Witsius. And so I admit that's why I began reading him, but Herman Witsius, as a Dutch theologian, part of the Nader Reformati, really weds together a very robust theology with a very deep piety. And the way in which he is able to write, he is brilliant. I mean, bar none, brilliant. But I never have read something by him where I have not been moved to a deep gratitude and devotion and really worship to God. And that's what the Dutch theologians were really known for. And Herman Witsius really weds scholasticism with piety. That, and he's an extremely clear thinker. That is something that is so lacking in so many theologians. But he is able to walk through certain issues with profound clarity, and at many times in a way too with a profound simplicity. And so those things I appreciate. I also, he wrote very much from a pastor's heart. He has a phenomenal book that I think has been republished under the title, The Character of a True Theologian, which was the address that he gave when he became a professor in Utrecht. And he concludes that really in this way that has impacted me as a pastor, where he tells his students in the conclusion of this inaugural address, whatever I do, I now do for you. I read for you, I write for you, I labor for you, you have all my heart and all my mind. And that was very formative to me as I was studying to be a pastor, just seeing that that heart on display in this great thinker, that he really gave himself to those that he was entrusted to. And I appreciate that. And I appreciate too, he's very irenical. You know, he doesn't back away from polemics, and that's good for me. I have a bit of a polemical edge that I have prayed and prayed and prayed over the last 15 years to be sanctified. And Hermann Witsius really gets that. He does not shy away from controversy, but the way in which he approaches it is something really to be imitated in the way in which he deals with his opponents. So just for some of those reasons, he's just been very, very formative for my own thinking.
Yeah. So were both of those authors, you both said John Calvin. Obviously in Reformed seminaries, you studied John Calvin or dealt with his institutes quite a bit, but were the other authors that you mentioned, the other theologians, did you study them as well, or is that just something that you picked up on the side?
No, for me, that Turton was referenced, but it wasn't really highlighted very significantly when I was going through RPTS. I've begun to use him more and refer to him more in some of my own teaching. His theological works were used like at Princeton and were very profound in American Reformed seminaries up until the last century. So, and one of the things that we are seeing, I think, in not only just in seminaries, but in theological education, renewed emphasis in the classics, are people are picking these types of books up again and starting to read them, even lay people reading them. So I think that's a encouraging sign.
Obviously, Calvin was mandatory reading, the seminary that I went to. Witsius was not. He may have been referenced in my covenant theology class, but we did not make use of Witsius. So that was something I picked up on my own.
Well, and both of you mentioned lay people. And to be honest with you, most lay people don't have the time and I'm just speaking for myself, to really digest some of these theological works. And so, we hear about, Witsius or Turton, or it seems almost out of grasp for the layperson. Are they accessible to a layperson? I mean, if somebody, a church member ask you, hey, should I read this book by either one of these two guys? Would you recommend it?
Yeah, I would slightly disagree with you, Scott, because I do think lay people, I would agree with you, they don't have the kind of time that a minister should have to spending time studying, reading books. But it is a matter of options and choices. I mean,
sure,
you get people like Amy Bird, the housewife theologian. She's obviously very well read. There are a lot of, I know that I've known several lay people whose libraries are bigger than mine, who regularly ask me about books, and I learn about books from them. So I do think lay people should be encouraged to read. I know you mean that. One of the things that's taking place right now is the formation of reading groups. And I can't remember if we've mentioned on a previous podcast. Yeah, we interviewed. Sorry, I remember we interviewed Michael Allen, who is running, along with Scott Swain out of RTS, the Paideia Center for Theological Discipleship. And at RPTS last year, we sponsored a group, and they read through Gregory of Nazianzus' work, one of his works, and some of his works, and Martin Luther's Larger Catechism. This coming year, they're picking up some other church fathers. So these are lay people coming, and once a month, they're given reading assignments and then coming together and having theological discussions. And I just happened to be in the visiting a family in the church, and they had a relative that lived up in northern Pennsylvania, and he just happened to mention that he was attending one of these reading groups up at Grove City College that Dr. Truman's going to be leading. And I've heard these are really popping up all over the country. So that's a good way for people. They could go on the website for the Paideia Center and find a reading group perhaps in their area and join one of those if they'd like.
Sure. And I guess that the question probably came out wrong, but you know, and I appreciate the reading groups, but there's, and I appreciate the fact that pastors have to, it's part of their job. Mm-hmm. I would say spend time in these kind of things to really delve deep into issues and topics. I guess my question was, is it accessible to the average lay person? Are these kind of theologians accessible to lay people?
Whenever you read dead theologians, it's a bit of an acquired taste. You know, is it totally accessible? My wife will probably never read Herman Witsius in The Economy of the Covenants Between God and Man. But, you know, I began reading Witsius when I was still a lay person. I wasn't even a seminary student. And I guess my encouragement to people would be, it is a bit of an acquired taste. I know, you know, Turretin's three volumes is just massive and can be really intimidating. But really, especially the older theologians, I think, have more value in a paragraph than most living authors have in an entire book. And I mean that. It sounds cheeky.
Barry.
C.S. Lewis would agree with you.
Yes. And they are, in my mind, it's well worth the difficult work of acquiring a taste for them.
Well, not to even promote my book, but just agree with what you're saying, because I felt like my book was just trying to open the door to go back and discover what the former theologians had written about and try to make that accessible to people. So I totally agree with that there is so much depth and knowledge that God has granted to the church in former generations, and the types of books that we're mentioning here have lasted. They've made the test of time, and so they're good to go back to. I think too, this is part of our pastoral ministry, the ministry of an elder, is when we're seeing people hungry for truth, we have to realize that there are different levels of folks in a congregation. There are more educated, less educated. So, and sometimes it's not even education. Kyle mentioned his wife. She's a very bright lady. It just might be interest.
Yes, she is. So let their record reflect.
Yes. So there has to be an array of different books. Someone might not pick up a thick theology book, but if there's a topic of interest and there's a Puritan who wrote on it, they might just wolf that one right down. So I think that's part of helping and guiding people into reading, is having a variety of different books that recommend them.
Well, that's a great segue into my next question. You would think we'd plan this, but honestly, we didn't. If you had a young person come to you and say, I really want to study theology, I want to learn, what book would you recommend?
Well, the first one that pops in my mind, well, there's two, because they both introduced me, and one's dead now, one's not quite dead.
We don't have to make that distinction in this, I guess.
But
it's kind of morbid.
They introduced me to the Puritans. Was my first Christian book I read was The Pursuit of Holiness by Jerry Bridges, who loved the Puritans and quoted them often. And that's just a wonderful book on walking in the holiness that Christ has provided to us. And then another one is a classic, Knowing God by J.I. Packer. He's still alive. And that book's a wonderful theological treatment on the person of God and how it is that we can come to know him.
What about you, Kyle? What would you recommend?
I would concur with Knowing God for Sure by J.I. Packer. I think that has been a gateway drug for so many of us. And and it's actually, it's not a book either that you leave at the gateway. I still go back to it. Mm-hmm. And J.I. Packer's ability to give a biblical picture of a very big God is so, so necessary. So that's a place that I would encourage a young person to begin. I have often, and you always gauge people, right? Because I realize that my book tastes are not going to be everybody's book tastes. I find J.C. Ryle to be mm-hmm. extremely devotional and extremely useful. His book, Old Paths, is a really good basic, almost systematic theology that I would have no qualms recommending to somebody who wants to understand that. So that would be another one.
It's Thoughts for Young Men is a great book to give to young men.
Yeah, yeah. You know, and I do think, it depends, you know, you got to gauge, this is one of the challenges as a pastor, you've got to gauge where is this person, what are they looking for, what will be most helpful to them. You know, if I had a young punk like Kyle Borg come up to me the way that I was 15 years ago, I think one of the first pieces of advice that I would give is, you know, you need to pick up a book like Jonathan Edwards, Charity and Its Fruits, Hugh Binning, A Treatise on Christian Love, because the first thing you need to get cemented in your head is that all truth ought to make you a person of love towards God and towards your neighbor. You know, a lot of young men who get into reading theology are just jerks. Mm-hmm. And they are pursuing a wrong end. And I think both those, Jonathan Edwards, Hugh Binning, really aim at what is Christian love, and let that be the grace that adorns you in all of your theological studies.
It's ironic that the Reformed faith, I'll get back to you, Barry, but the Reformed faith teaches grace above all else. You know, everything you have is by grace, and yet we are sometimes the most arrogant, pompous people. When we're young, there's a gentleman in our church who says, you know, when a person becomes a Calvinist, we should lock him up in a cage for a year and let him simmer down a little bit, just because we can come across. And I think those are great recommendations to temper that.
And to go with it, you know, it's called the cage phase. And sometimes we laugh, but there's actually nothing funny about it. No. Many young, zealous men have shot their mouths off and they ruin people. Like, it's not, you know, I've dealt with people who laugh and, oh, I'm in the cage stage right now. And it's like, it's not funny. You lack Christian love. And Paul tells us exactly what that means in 1 Corinthians 13. You're nothing and you've gained nothing. And so, you know, I agree, Scott. And that's why I think, especially with, or a character of a true theologian, I think Herman Witsius is a great place to start there too, to show you the piety if you're going to embark on these types of studies.
And I'm sorry, Barry, you were getting ready to say something.
Well, it ties right into what you guys are talking about here. I think one of the antidotes to this also is reading biographies. So it's not just theology books, but we're actually reading the stories of God's people throughout church history. I like to, particularly in the summertime, pick up a biography and read it. It's always humbling to see people who have suffered for their faith or the great sacrifices they've made, and it just puts you in your place, to speak. So again, if I was talking to young people, I often encourage them to read like Jim Elliott's, the stories regarding Jim Elliott, or, you know, in the Reformed Presbyterian Church, we like to, the missionary story of John G. Payton is just incredible.
Yay! Yeah. Incredible. And remove some of the romance of what you think a missionary life might, you know,
right.
Spending nights in trees so he doesn't get eaten by cannibals. So.
Or guarding his landing on shore and having his wife give birth to a child only to die, and then the child dying and him having to guard the tombs from the cannibals. So.
Yeah.
Yeah, I remember doing a Sunday school class on the book Fair Sunshine. Fair Sunshine. Just an incredible book. Teaches you humility and grace, and you know, just the true stories of the martyrs for the Reformed faith. So, as you're saying, telling me all this stuff, I just get more and more questions in my mind. Barry, what are some of the biographies? I know you just mentioned some, but what are some of the best biographies you could recommend for seminary students or for, you know, somebody in your church?
I like reading Ian Murray. He's written some biographies, so going to him as an author is important. He's written on Martin Lloyd-Jones or J.C. Ryle that Kyle mentioned earlier. He also has written on Spurgeon, some of his life stories, which are fascinating. So that would be one place to start. Kyle, what about you? I'll think of some others.
You have to think about it.
Yes.
The Memoir and Remains of Robert Murray McShane, I think is one of the most stupendous biographies ever written. And with that as well, I forget what it's been published under, but basically The Diary of Andrew Bonar is a very moving biography as well, looking at the life of a very godly Scottish Presbyterian. Those have been great encouragements to me, as well as there's that biography on Elizabeth Prentice, which I think is very good. And I think everybody ought to read biographies of very godly women as well, and not just our favorite pastors and theologians, but very godly women who have done much for the kingdom.
Yeah, Rebecca Van Dudewaard has a book on some of the they were prominent, but maybe less known Christian women during the time of the Reformation. I really appreciated reading her work.
Prepared to Stand Alone. I forget who the author of that is, but on the life of J.C. Ryle is a phenomenal biography as well. So
that is Murray. Ian
That's
Murray.
Right. Yeah. Thank you. That's right.
So we've talked about a lot of dead authors, which makes Kyle happy. That was my goal today, is to make Kyle happy. He's not a very happy person by nature, I don't think.
That's true.
So who are some of the modern church authors that you like, have been influential in your life? And by modern, I mean like second half of the 20th century into now. Are there any that stand out?
He's still dead too. There is something about dead authors whose works have stood the test of time, who aren't just knee jerk, maybe writing against certain things. Mm-hmm. So that's why I appreciate dead authors. But John Murray is a phenomenal thinker, and really, I think, helped reclaim an exegetical tradition to the Reformed faith. I think we owe a huge 20th century debt of gratitude to John Murray. He'd be the first one that I'd throw out.
Well, some obvious people. R.C. Sproul's been hugely influential to me. I know he's now dead, but he's just passed away here about 2 years ago. I've read a number of his works. I love Sinclair Ferguson. I love to hear him preach even more than I like to hear his writing, but his writing is always so clear and helpful. So those are a couple of guys that spring to mind.
Okay. And I think, too, we've mentioned her already, but Amy Bird has some really good provocative things. Whether you agree with her totally or not, I find her writing to be very helpful.
Okay. Very interesting. I like Van Til, which he's not the best writer, but I just love reading his books. And I'm getting some...
It's the lawyer in you.
Yeah, I've really appreciated the clarity in his thinking, maybe not necessarily in his writing always, but... I do like him. He is dead, Kyle. So
yeah,
that should
I know.
At least
That's
that
okay.
should go for something.
That's good. That's good.
I should probably say I like living authors. I like Dr. Gamble, Dr. Williams.
Rutt.
I better
don't forget Rutt.
Yeah,
you know.
Rutt, yes.
Barry, do you like yourself? Barry is the only published author here on Three Guys Theologizing.
That is true. So if I were to ask you, guys...
Well, real quick, can I answer one more? Okay,
no,
sorry.
Yes, you can. I'm joking, Kyle. Go ahead.
Okay, so he is dead, but he's more modern. And I know I'm probably going to get backlash from some people, but C.S. Lewis. He is not going to be a cookie cutter. He's not going to fall into the Reformed tradition. And there are some things that he wrote that needs to be read with a critical eye, but I have an extremely soft spot in my heart for C.S. Lewis. A profound thinker, I think. Very imaginative, sometimes getting him in trouble, but well worth picking up some of his books.
Okay. No, that was fine.
See, I can read outside my tradition.
And that's good. So if I came up to you, everybody has it. What's your favorite book in your library? I have to know, you know, the one that I love this book. It's my favorite.
Well, I know it's going to be cliche because there's a number of people in our circles who would probably say the same, but John Owen's The Mortification of Sin. I think it was J.I. Packer who said he owed more to that book than any book outside of scripture that's ever been written. And I'm just going to steal it. That has been the most influential book in my life.
I love Jeremiah Burroughs, and I love two of his books.
The Congregationalist? Just kidding. Go on.
No, I just love his gospel worship book, just for the clarity it gives in worship. But I think if I had to say which one's my favorite, I really do love The Rare Jewel of Christian Contentment. It's just such a humbling book, and it's devotional, and it really makes you think about your relationship with God and how you should, in every situation of life, you should be exercising contentment and trust in the Lord. And so I find it be extremely practical and well written, and it just gets to my heart every time I pick it up. So that's got to be right up there. It's one of my favorite.
So just as an aside, I remember about 10 years ago or 11 years ago, somebody asked me, Scott, have you ever thought about going to seminary? And my response was, yes, that's why I went to law school. And truly, that's what I said. And the reason is, you know, you ask me what my favorite book is, it's nothing like, it's the Lectures on Unbelief and Revolution by Groen von Prinzscher. By far has been it's probably my favorite book ever. It's lectures given back in like the 1850s by a Dutch historian, theologian. He was kind of the precursor to Kuyper. Just a brilliant book. I know. But you know, here you guys are, these really great thought out answers. And I'm talking about, you know, the difference between the revolution in France versus Great Britain and how that's, I just think that's a great thing. Shows you why I'm not a pastor.
It's good to be well-read and to read beyond just theology books.
That's
the topic of this, but I think that's important. I do encourage my students. I think this gets back to this idea of young men who are tearing people up. I've even heard some guys who think they're very sharp and theologically, they'll say you shouldn't read novels or you shouldn't read fiction, or I don't read fiction, as if that's some type of badge of honor. And I sort of shake my head at poor soul that has no imagination.
And, right.
You don't realize all that you're
missing. What a sad world.
Yeah. What a sad world that you live.
And we are like right up at our time, but I did want to ask you, what's your favorite nonfiction or your favorite fiction book? If you had to pick your favorite fiction author, or your favorite fiction book, what is it?
Well, if you go with author, I love P.G. Wodehouse, so there's a lot to choose from there.
Yeah.
In terms of just some, actually in the summer, I'll also just for some light reading, pick up one of, I've been stiff upper lip Jeeves right now. I picked up John Grisham's latest, The Reckoning, and having fun reading through that right now. So I enjoy, he tells a good story.
My favorite fiction author, Doug Wilson. Oh, did I say that? Oh, no. Surgeon General's warning, I would not recommend reading much coming out of Moscow, Idaho. My favorite fiction, again, probably cliche in many people's worlds, but J.R.R. Tolkien. I love imagination. Yeah. And J.R.R. Tolkien's imagination is the most gifted imagination of any person I think that's ever lived. And of his works, of course, there's always the standard Lord of the Rings, Hobbit, which are great. Silmarillion's phenomenal. But I think his book, The Children of Hurin, is one of the greatest books he ever wrote.
All right. Nobody went with Dr. Seuss, who I think has... you have to be brilliant to write that stuff.
Yes. I love... Whenever my kids, you know, sometimes... Kids bring to you books and they want it read like Danny and the Dinosaur, and you're just like, ugh, I'm so sick of Dan. I never get sick of Dr. Seuss.
Well, you can read it so many ways. It's so much fun. I mean, by far my favorite author, because that's about my reading level.
Oh, right.
But I do, I kid. I do like reading Dr. Seuss, and I admire him. But well, I think that's about it for the time that we have. I don't know if we answered all your questions or not, Isaiah. Hopefully, you know, you heard a little bit that piqued your interest. Hopefully you learned a little bit more about us and who we are and what has influenced us. And so with that, we will leave you to your reading. Make sure you have a nice balanced reading diet, right? We need some good old-fashioned dead people books, some new modern books that deal with topics, and a good fiction book to boot. So we'll leave you with that. We are thankful that you joined us, and we look forward to meeting again together on this podcast.